Hello, Josie.
Hello.
So thank you so much for talking to me or for agreeing to talk to me today. I want to talk to you for like a million reasons, but I guess my main motivation for reaching out to you was just that I've been following you and Cake and Loaf for pretty much as long as I've been in business. And I really admire and respect the thought that you put into being an employer. So, which I think in our industry is not always a given. I think a lot of business owners in the food industry are just really passionate about their craft. And the thought of like, what does it take to run a business and be an employer isn't always kind of front of mind when we're first starting out. But yeah, so I recently read a book. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's by Corey Mintz. It's called The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them and What Comes After. So it's just come out kind of, I think, in the last year. And it really put into words what I've been thinking about so much, just in terms of the food industry at large, kind of being at a time of massive flux. Mm-hmm. And things are changing, and it kind of feels like we're at a pivotal point where we can't really ignore what's going on underneath it all. And I think that's what this author does so well in this book. And as somebody who's kind of had a different approach from day one, and you know, whose business has kind of been resilient through a lot of turmoil, I really wanted to kind of understand and get at the heart of like what you think is behind that. Mm-hmm. So before we dive into all that, maybe you could start with telling me a little bit about you and your business. And where you are and your role, whatever you'd like to share.
Yeah. So, my name's Josie and I own Cake and Loaf Bakery with another woman, Nikki Miller. And you're right. Like when we started a business, we absolutely started the complete opposite way. We were thinking, okay, like we live within this system and we know that parts of the system are broken because we had seen it in our workplaces. We had been working at bakeries where sexual harassment was a real issue. Time theft was a real issue. Or I guess wage theft, you would call it, but like having people work overtime and not compensating them, stuff like that. And primarily, although we are totally passionate about the food we make, and that is primarily what drives us, we really wanted to create a workplace we wanted to be in. We wanted to have coworkers, you know, that we respected, and we respected their craft, but we also respected their home lives. And so we really did take like from the bottom approach saying, okay, we're not just creating baked goods, we're creating careers. What do those careers look like? How do people age in them? All sorts of considerations that we thought that the bakeries we had worked at hadn't been able to consider or didn't care to consider. It kind of depends on the bakery. So we started our bakery. Originally, we decided to start a bakery in 2008. It took us a couple years to get it off the ground. And while we were doing that, we did farmers markets and we created a CSB. And then in 2011, we were able to actually like open our doors at our bakery. And ever since then, it has been a real challenge to balance this. Like our primary goal is to create great careers. Our secondary goal is to create great food. Mm-hmm. And our tertiary goal is to enrich our community. And all of those can be conflicting. All of those can be really difficult because of outside forces. And it's hard to be competitive, obviously. If you choose to run a business like that, you have to really make sure that the customer understands that those are the inputs going in. So you're competing, you know, you're not competing with businesses not doing that kind of thing.
There's so much in what you just said. I'm curious maybe for people who aren't familiar with Cake and Loaf, mm-hmm. can you tell us a little bit about what that workplace looks like? So how many people are you guys employing? What kinds of food do you make? Just kind of paint us a picture of what your bakery in your shop looks like.
Yeah, so fundamentally we are a from scratch neighborhood bakery. We make a wide range of products from like lunch stuff, like, you know, pizzas and salads and sandwiches to like delicious savory stuff like chicken pot pies. And then everything you expect from a neighborhood bakery, cookies, scones, all of that. We have, because we've been around for 15 years now, like we've been through quite a journey. And bef- in 2019-2020, we had about 30 staff, we had two locations, and we were making an even broader range of products, including confections and daily bread. Now in 2023, it looks a little different. We have about 12 employees in just one location, but the range of products is pretty much the same. And our primary focus is serving the community and our immediate neighborhood. But we also make things like custom cakes that people travel from Niagara and Toronto and Brantford to get as well.
Nice. I'm curious about when you guys first opened, just kind of as a follow-up to what you were saying before. When you first opened, did your approach, I'm not sure how public you were about talking about yourselves as employers and kind of presenting yourself or representing yourself in a way as like a conscientious employer, but did you have people raise their eyebrows or kind of like put any doubt in your minds that what you were trying to do was weird? Or did you feel any kind of tension around that? Because I remember when I did an interview as we were opening and I talked about, yeah, like I'm going to try to pay my employees like above minimum wage. And it was just, that was in 2013. And at the time that seemed really like really counter to what people thought it took to run a successful food business. And I can imagine in 2008 that it was pretty similar, or if not more strange. Do you have any recollection of what that was like?
Oh, totally. And I think like you just nailed it, right? Like people don't think you can run a successful business, but what does success look like, right? Like for us, we were just, you know, hyper aware that we lived in this system that was defining success in a way that we didn't agree with. Like it's not successful to make a lot of money and have a bunch of employees working at minimum wage and not being able to meet their own bills. Like I'm not going on vacations while my employees are worried about how they're going to put food on the table. That is not success to me. Mm-hmm. And it never was success to us. So there was a lot of doubt. There was a lot of doubt about our pricing structure, although it was costed like to the penny. And it was very much, you know, we were making this 5% profit margin and that was it, how we costed things, but people were still really intimidated in 2011 by a $5 loaf of bread. Like that seemed extreme, even though the bread takes 3 days to make, right? I think fundamentally it is always super challenging to push back against a system. You have to ignore the voices that you don't respect and you have to seek out voices that you respect what they're doing. And so the things they are advising you on might make sense to you. You can't just listen to anybody.
Oh, I absolutely love that perspective. And it reminds me of kind of where I was as well at the beginning of my business journey, I guess. I felt like I was coming at it. It sounds like maybe you were too, from a background of just having worked in kitchens. Is that right?
Yeah. I came out of the mortgage industry too. So Nikki had just worked in. He had 12 years of experience managing, running kitchens. I had been in the culinary field, but kind of on and off. And I'd only really had like 3 years of experience in kitchens. And actually it was my exposure to the mortgage industry that solidified how we were going to run our business, because I saw what everyone made. Like I saw all these applications come through. I saw exactly what kind of careers paid what, and I met those people and I understood a little bit about like what their, you know, work life looked like because we had had conversations. And so I had this like super broad understanding of what employment looks like. And I could see very clearly how classism and racism and sexism had played into this structure of, you know, kitchens, bakeries, or restaurants, just the expectations are lower. But that didn't have to be true, I didn't think.
That's so interesting. That's like not what I thought you were going to say at all. I had no idea that you were in the mortgage business. So from that experience, you, I guess, were exposed to the big wage gaps, I guess. And yeah, that yeah. was the thing that was really shocking.
And the
you.
Realities of the financial sector and how rich people use money versus right. poor people, and the types of opportunities that privilege affords that might be invisible to a lot of people. Like it was an education in the economy, basically.
Right. That makes total sense. Yeah. So I came at it from having worked in like two very formative experiences. One was like working in restaurants and bakeries. And then the other was I had previously worked for a labor union. So I was conscientious of, I guess, like labor issues in general, mm-hmm. and what people were fighting for when they were trying to join unions. And it was kind of, it was a government union. So it was very different than the issues that, like pretty different from the issues that people in our sector work in. But all that to say, like when I first opened, I really felt like alone in the business community. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until like I just didn't talk very much to my peers. Like I remember a conversation in maybe my first year where we were supplying a business with bread, and the owner would come in and chat with me, and he was always kind of like upset about how hard things were in the restaurant. And I was like, yeah, same, you know, and we had solidarity with each other. But then one day he said, like, I bit the bullet. I decided to put everyone on salary. Like I can't afford to pay people what, you know, an hourly wage. And that's a major cop out for people in our industry. And I was very careful after that in talking to him, because I thought, okay, like we don't see eye to eye. And for anybody who's not familiar with that, you know, salarying employees in restaurants is often a way to essentially conduct wage theft. So mm-hmm. they're working for many more hours than they're actually being paid for. And that was kind of the vibe that I got from most of my peers in the industry. And so it wasn't until the Better Way Alliance started working on the issue of like minimum wages and stuff in 2017, where just, you know, a group of businesses came together to say like, this is good. And I started paying closer attention to like other people in other cities, provinces, and that, oh, there is this kind of loose, like, you know, network of businesses that are approaching things differently. And mm-hmm. I did a presentation, and this was kind of my first like feeling of, oh, there are other businesses that are similar to mine, and I'm not the only one who sees things differently. And it was, I had read an article in the Baker's Journal about you guys. And there was this quote that I used, and I wanted to share it with you, but I did a presentation at Ryerson University. You had this quote in it, and I went and found it, and it said, everyone works hard and everyone has a slightly different skill set, but everyone is contributing equally. You can be competitive and still be generous. And I just thought, like, I don't know how that feels to you now, many years later, if that still rings true. But at the time, I just was like, Josie and Nikki are doing amazing things, and like, I can try to be that too. And it just, I wanted you to know that, like, that kind of reading that about you guys made me feel like I wasn't just a stupid business person who was trying to do something completely, like, I didn't know if I was a good business person at the time. And now I know, I'm like, okay, I'm doing something well, but at the time I was like, okay, maybe there is some truth to this.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, I guess that's what we hoped would happen, because we were also living that, right? Like, are we doing the right thing? Is this ever going to work? Because most forces seemed against us. I mean, you've walked the walk now, so you know, right? Like, it's a constant uphill battle. I just love the idea that, like, at our most insecure, we were still inspiring people, because it's hard, right? Like, we just really didn't really know what we were doing. We were just trying to be good. Like, every decision was just like, how can we make the best decision for the most number of people? That quote still totally resonates. We have a pretty like flat structure at Cake and Loaf. Our employees are generally like, I mean, everyone is equal as a human being, but also like as a skill set, everyone is very talented. Everyone is trained up. Everyone deserves to be there. That's lovely.
That's so different. Like, that perspective is so different. And I did want to kind of talk to you a bit about the idea of workplace culture and mm-hmm. what it means to create a culture, because as much as there can be like I am pro like legislating better employment standards. I'm not trying to say that that's not important because it is, but I am curious to know how much thought you put into creating that culture and how that kind of translates like on the ground, because like we have come from, a lot of us in the industry have come from kind of toxic workplaces that were, you know, had lots and lots of issues in them. But when you speak about everybody having value, that's like really counter culture. And I have talked to a lot of people over the years about how to deal with specific human resources issues as they're coming up. And I'm a very, I lead with, you know, my emotional brain a lot of the time, because I think that my emotional brain has a lot of smart things to tell me. And I'm often told like, you know, let that person go or like move on, or, you know, this kind of feeling of like disposability that is like ingrained into our culture. And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just curious, how do you project your value systems like into your business, and how do you build those in?
Two major things around like staff specifically. First of all, like, yeah, people are not disposable. People go through phases in their lives. And sometimes the employee is useless, right? Because they're going through a personal crisis, or they've, something has happened to them that is big enough that it has affected them temporarily. I just believe in loyalty. Like, you don't throw someone out because of that. You work with them and you try to figure out like, what is going on? Do you need some time off? Do you need a different position for a little while? Like, those I've maybe felt, and we've definitely been accused of holding on to people longer than was like business savvy as employees. But that's out of respect for what they contributed when they were a perfect employee, right? Like, it's not, I just think like loyalty goes both ways, and you need to kind of see people through different phases of their life. If you're expecting them to work for you for 10, 20, 30 years, yeah, there's going to be years where stuff is happening and they are not completely themselves, or like they have a baby or something, right? And like that, yeah, you're not going to be as useful as an employee during that time period. But we want you to have babies and we want you to be able to have that life. So like, we have to respect that and we have to work with it to some extent. If people abuse that, that's a totally different situation, but we don't have that happen. Like, people don't abuse it because it's a very human level interaction. The other thing that was like the most painful thing I've probably ever done and still remains a little painful to be honest, is allowing employees to evaluate us anonymously. In the early days, that was harsh because, you know what, I actually wasn't that good at managing. Like, I now know I have ADHD. I'm a super literal person. I communicate very directly. Like, I don't really get small talk. Like, I just need you to communicate. I don't want all the fluff. And so that came off in my early days as bitchy and pushy. And like, some people really need you to kind of walk them there. They can't, like when you get to know me, yeah, maybe that direct communication is okay. But I was often like considered cold, like all these things. And so I didn't know that about myself, because your friends don't tell you that stuff. So when your employees tell you, and you think you've been doing this amazing job, like that really, it hit hard and it took a little while to digest. And I was probably pretty like defiant about it at first, but I've changed a lot in the 15 years I've been managing people. And I think I'm a way better manager because I was able to kind of say, okay, like, you're not doing that on purpose, but you're doing it. So how do we stop that? How do we work with it? How do we like communicate better? And Nikki, my partner, went through the same kind of arc, right? Like different issues but like, yeah, getting honest feedback is very, very hard. It can hurt your feelings, but it's so important in the long run.
I can say that I've never done that before. And that's really brave.
I didn't think it was brave. I thought they were going to be nice to me. But then I was like, oh, I'm not perfect. This is a great lesson.
I feel like there is so much wisdom in taking that approach, but because what I have found is that it takes me a really long time to figure out how people really feel about me. And sometimes I have it way wrong. Like, I think somebody is not, you know, not into my style, but then it turns out that it actually really works for them, or vice versa. And so I think that's really smart. I also, just to pick up on something you said about how your communication style and stuff didn't always work for people. Mm-hmm. I found that one of the hard, I love talking about management. I could talk about management like all day because I've put so much thought into it out of necessity. But I find something that's really hard about our job is to understand that each person that works for you is a unique individual, and you, part of our job, I think, and you can, I'd love to hear what you think about this, but part of our job is to understand how each person operates individually and to tailor our approach accordingly. And I think that that's a really big, like, that's how I approach management now, is that I'm like, okay, this person prefers to talk about things in this way, this person prefers this way, and I put a lot of effort into understanding each individual, but that's like a lot of labor and effort for me to do. And I've come to the conclusion that that is the job of a manager, but I'd be curious to know how your trajectory has gone. Is like, what do you think is our responsibility and job as managers in that way?
Yeah, I fundamentally totally agree that you need to be aware of the unique nature of every employee. Because if you're investing in these people, again, for decades, hopefully, right? Like, you need an intimate enough understanding to be able to approach them in a way that's respectful. But it's also a real challenge. I found it a real challenge anyway, to keep doing that, but also make sure you're applying things fairly. So the only problem is, like, you get into a situation where, like, the squeaky wheel gets the grease sometimes, right? So you might have a person who is, like, naturally an introvert, or, like, whatever, has something about them that makes them less willing to come forward with needs, less obvious that they have needs. And so that, like, I think early on it was like, yeah, okay, I got this. I just got to, like, do the individual personalities and that'll be fine. And then it was like, okay, but then how do I make sure people who are, I don't know, people with kids might end up with more time off, right? Because I sympathize with that. I have a kid. I understand exactly what your life looks like. But maybe someone who has, like, just as valid a reason to have a little bit more time off might not get that attention from me. So that's still a tension that I'm not totally sure how to solve, which is why I think, I mean, that's why policies exist, right? To apply things fairly. But then we're hyper aware when you work right next to a person that, like, that doesn't always make sense either. So I think I don't have a perfect response there, but it's an ongoing effort to just be like, how do you do this better? Right? Like, how do you create true accessibility, I guess, at a job is what I've been thinking about a lot. Yeah.
I think that, yeah, you're kind of talking, I think, a bit about, like, equity essentially.
Yes,
and, like, exactly. How to build equity, like, and fairness into our organizations, which I think is like something that is so crucial to building a resilient and, like, successful organization, but that, like, as food service businesses is so, like, I trained as a baker and now I'm like, diversity, yeah, equity, inclusion, you know. Yeah. I'm like, what? Yeah. What am I doing? But the reality is like, if you are going to build a successful, like, decades long business, you kind of have to be asking yourself, like, how do I deal with accessibility issues? How do I deal with, like, discrimination and, you know, unfair, like, application of policies? How are my policies biased? How am I... Yeah. Involving
what bias. Are my biases?
What are my, like, biases? Yeah. Yeah. And that's like often really hard work and really humbling work, because you sometimes only learn that through somebody getting hurt. Mm-hmm. And that has been a really, really hard process for me. And sometimes that has been one of the, like, like, you know those days where you're like, I should just give up now?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever felt that before.
I think every entrepreneur feels that. Yes. I don't think
yeah. that,
Yeah.
So I sometimes have like these real, like every day I'm like, this is stupid. But then I like, it's done. It's over. We move through it. Like the challenges. Yeah. But when you realize that like something that's going on in your workplace has been like hurting someone or is not fair or has been like holding someone back who should be succeeding better. Like that's the type of stuff where I'm like, oh God, I'm in way over my head. And I think it's great that you're thinking about that, but it's like, yeah, I don't know how we
navigate it. To be fair, the laundry list of my regrets around that is just as long as our successes. Like it's not, that's the point, right? Like when you're trying to do things well, it is a never ending thing because you'll kind of nail one part of it and you're like, awesome, we got that. And then it's like, oh, I didn't even think about this or this or this or this. Mm-hmm. But I think that's kind of the beauty of it. Like it's, we are trying to create justice in an unjust world. And so of course it's an uphill battle. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I'm often reminded of how like our success influences others, how our success builds confidence in people. Like even if those employees don't stay with me, they learn what they're worth. And they know what they deserve and they will go to other workplaces and they will demand that because that is their rights. Like they do have legal rights that a lot of workplaces ignore. And I've had people come back and say like, because you treat me like that, I was able to stand up to this or this. And so, yeah, like I'm right there with you. Laundry list of regrets. Like there's a list of employees I think about calling all the time being like, I'm sorry. Like I didn't know what I didn't know. I wish it had been different. I could have made a different choice, but like you can't, you gotta go forward, right?
Yeah, I think it's really kind of refreshing and feels like a bit of a relief sometimes to talk about and like admit that even though we are kind of decent work champions and we try to talk about these things at every opportunity, we also are just trying to figure out what decent even means. And it's a lot more than just like, it's a lot more than just wages. That's like what we're advocating for often is just like the starting point. And like beyond that, we're actually trying to create something that's like fair and that helps people of all walks of life succeed. And that's like a really tall task. That's something that I feel often out of my depth in. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of nice to hear that somebody else is like has those same struggles. But yeah, I want to try to bring it back a little bit to like this idea of the bigger forces that are like at play, which I think we've started to scratch the surface on, like classism, racism, the types of things that are like that stop individuals from succeeding and that sometimes hold people back. I'm curious how you think about those forces and with regards to like how well you can do by your team. So like as a business owner, you only have so much control over their pay, their working conditions, their well-being, because so much of like our ability to, let's say, pay people better or whatever is shaped by consumer beliefs. Can you speak a little bit to like how like food service workers are impacted by that and like how that impacts your business? So like, yeah, however you want to interpret that, I guess.
Yeah, I think we certainly dreamed of a world where we could build a bakery where people made, you know, like $50,000 a year. We thought that was like a salary that maybe we could get to. And we worked really, really hard to do that. But yes, so what became increasingly obvious as years went on is the working conditions generally in the restaurant and baking industry were atrocious. They have improved a little bit because I think there was a lot of education around it, especially through like the Me Too movement too with sexual assault. I feel like we made great strides in that particular area. But it really hit home when my husband became an electrician. So I was doing my Red Seal pastry apprenticeship. He was doing his electrician's apprenticeship. We went to school for the same amount of time. We you know, did the same number of courses. And of course, like an electrician is a very important job and there is a lot of safety involved in that, but there is a lot of safety in food as well. At any point, we could poison large amounts of people and you have to make sure that you're following regulations and you're following safety rules and that your staff is educated enough to, you know, notice the subtleties about that. And it just felt incredibly unfair that at the end of this process, this pretty equal process that the two of us went through, that he was going to step into a career where his hourly package was $100, full benefits. And he could take that and work anywhere at that rate because that's what his union dictated. And he was lucky to be part of a big union in a big city. And so the rates were really, really high, but he could have gone anywhere in Canada and made easily three times what I could make trying to get a job with my red seal. And so I put that down largely to unionization, and I am a huge union supporter, and I grew up in a union friendly family. I think people have a lot of misplaced anger targeted at unions because they get some sort of oppression that they have, you know, more power than they should. But I think the reality is that they allow a large segment of the population who would maybe not have the ability to advocate for themselves to engage in these careers and make really good money and not have to have, you know, a master's degree or something that is not accessible to everybody. So fundamentally, it feels unfair. Fundamentally, it feels classist and racist and sexist, given the history of who works in kitchens versus the trades. The trades historically have been mainly white men in Canada, although obviously there's exceptions. Mm-hmm. I would love to see kitchens organized into unions. I know that that is completely contrary to what most employers would like to see, but I think it would have to take that kind of movement to shift the public's perception of what it takes to make food and what food costs. We're in an upsetting time for food costs, personally and professionally. I'm sure people are really feeling it for the first time. But I'm a little bit happy that people are like kind of understand my conversations now. They're like, oh, food costs is going to be crazy. I'm like, yes, we deal with that all the time. Like that volatile nature is part of our business and we are constantly facing that stress. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you feel like people, like the general public essentially is not, like, it's not necessarily about shifting big perspectives of the population or society, but it's more about like what could really shift the paradigm in terms of wages and career viability is more like organizing workers.
I don't think history, I think that's what history has taught us. Like, yeah. I just don't think you shift public perception quick enough to make a difference to people's lives. I mean, I don't want to say rebellion, but like it takes a large movement of organized people to get stuff like that done. And it doesn't usually come from the customers in industry, right? It has to come from the workers.
Yeah, there's so much pressure for, like, because I think I have a similar experience to you where I thought we would be in a different place. Like, I thought I would, you know, personally be in a different financial situation by now. You know, owning a business for 10 years, you think like, you know, I might have a normal person salary by this point. And it's just like, that's just not ever the, like, it's, I don't see how that's ever going to be the reality for me or for my team. Like we try, we slog, but really we're just kind of keeping up with the pace of inflation. And it's like, you can never really kind of get ahead of that. And so, you know, I have over the years thought about like, what would change that for our industry and for us? And I'm always kind of left with like, tear down all the systems, because it's like, there is no one single target. I feel like, I think that collective organizing, like you're saying, is probably the most powerful and impactful way to move the needle forward. Mm-hmm. And that just like seems like a really uphill battle, but I guess like on the flip side, it is happening in certain kind of pockets of our sector, like at, you know, Starbucks and like different kind of chains and stuff are getting organized. And so that's like an interesting development for our industry.
I think this is an ongoing issue too. Like you're saying, like we're exhausted, we're running out of course. Like this is where classism and privilege comes in, right? Like you don't have time to organize. You don't have the privilege to organize because you are working maybe 10 or 12 hour days and then you're going home and you're dealing with that stuff. So, I mean, not always, but largely a lot of people in the food industry are doing that. And so there's like a built-in control mechanism, right? Where you don't have enough energy to organize. So that's going to take enough desperation, really, which is what I think we often see in labor movements. And that's not great, but I think that's what will happen, right? Like if people get desperate enough and things don't change fast enough and costs keep rising, then something's going to break.
Yeah. I mean, we are, I think, seeing this like massive shift in even just the way our industry operates that I think is like as a result of, or maybe even causing like further degradation of the jobs and stuff is like the like introduction of big tech companies into the scene, you know, like the Ubers and the Skip the Dishes and all the ghost kitchens and stuff that are operating. Like our industry is like at risk of transforming from like bad jobs to like gig jobs, which are even worse. And that is like one of my bigger fears, is that because people, like the average consumer, is also strapped for cash and like looking for ways to save money on food, that like they're more and more tempted to go towards like cheap, convenient food. And like the tech giants have gone, you know, are getting into food. And that to me is like, I would really love our decision makers and policy makers to like really look at that and be like, how is the introduction of like those companies gonna like affect the labor landscape? Because we've already seen, like with Foodora, for example, when they tried to organize, like they were a delivery company, like they were kicked out of the country, like they left the country and they're no longer operating. And so it's like these are really, really powerful forces that are coming into the scene. And yeah, I just feel like that took a really dark turn. But you know, it is.
Well, yeah, because then again, in that model, where is the profit being made? It's being made by the food delivery owners, not even the people delivering the food, right? Like they are also making gig economy wages. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that might be a good kind of segue into my like sort of last big question that I was curious to ask you, which is like maybe a little bit out of our depth as business owners and bakers, but if we like, I'm curious if like I'm a big picture person, so we apply our values to our business, to the four walls in our business, but we're also people, we're civically engaged, we're leaders in our communities to some extent. And I think about things on like systems levels. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about like you as, let's say, you know, you wake up tomorrow and you're elected to office, you know, Josie for premier or prime minister or whatever. I want to know like, what actions are you taking to either address like issues that small businesses are facing or that workers are facing or both? Like how would you create kind of a little platform to kind of make our industry or like small business better or the conditions for workers better?
Yeah. I believe in a basic income. I think that the pandemic really like nailed that home for me. I believed in it before then, but I think fundamentally there's a lot of things broken about how we live our lives and how we interact as communities and how we make food. So first I would start with a basic income. I think families need someone at home. And that has completely disappeared over the years. It doesn't matter which parent or what kind of adult is home with those kids. But I think like that kind of hearth, right? Like to have this place where people are going to cook and they're going to respect food and they're going to shop at farmers markets and they're going to have the time to maybe grow their own vegetables or something. That food security, I think, would come out of time that would allow. So basic income for people in any community, I think what is, again, also kind of missing is like that idea that food is a community resource. There's a lot of great like community centers that have public gardens and public kitchens. And I would love to see that in every community. I know the community I live in now in Nova Scotia doesn't really have anything like that, because I think historically that happened like in churches and stuff, and people have gotten away from it. So I would fund like crazy. I would give all of the funding to small scale food producers, food businesses, farmers markets, and teach people to cook again. Like, I want to sell them food, but I want them to understand how to cook so they know the type of stuff that goes into it. So I guess that's my utopia.
That's your platform.
Reconnect with their food. Yeah. Where they reconnect with the land, they reconnect with the food. And I think out of that comes a shift in how they view climate change, how they view community building, how we view supporting people in our community that can't support themselves. I think we would be happier if we just had more meals together.
I love that, because it also reinforces the like value of kind of local sustainable systems, which like we saw break down so badly during the pandemic. Like, I think one thing that was revealed among so many was just how fragile our like messy global food system is, and how actually like it doesn't actually serve us when like the shit hits the fan. And like investing more in like those local systems is so crucial. And I really started thinking about that a lot as the pandemic happened. I was like, how do I invest more in like, how do I buy more from farmers? How do I, you know, produce more within my own little backyard? And you also gave me warm, fuzzy feelings about like how, as we grow and age and like my relationship to family has like really evolved in like the last few years. And I don't know if you want to like maybe talk a little bit about this, but just the feeling of like being able to invest in our homes. Like I felt you on like a visceral level when you were talking about having somebody stay at home and be like a home, like a caretaker for like your family and the people you love. Like, as a business owner, it like occupied such a big space in my life for such a long time, that I like my home life, like I don't have kids, and I have a great partner, and, you know, but my home wasn't necessarily the thing that I wanted to invest a lot of time in, because I was so, like invested in building my business. But now that's like really shifted for me. And I think more about like, how do we make this happen under this like really intense economic system that we are currently living in? And like, I've changed. I'm 10 years older. I have two pets that I adore. I have a home that I want to take care of. And like, that's like not possible. It's like barely, you know, I just have these tiny little moments where I'm like, I'm doing something good at home right now. But I don't know, like, I'm curious to know how your, just like how your relationship to home and family has changed for you.
Like the biggest lie I was ever told as an entrepreneur was like, if you just hustle hard enough, you'll have success. That's a lie. it's not about working harder. It's not about just putting in more hours. And like, I lived that lie for a long time. I neglected things I probably shouldn't have neglected. And I know my business partner feels the same. Like, it feels as entrepreneurs that it's all, like, it is all on you, but it also feels like it's all your fault. Like, if you could just do things better, then everything would line up, right? If you personally could just fix this, everything would line up. And people put that pressure on you, and you put it on yourself. And it's certainly like part of the hustle culture is like, well, just work harder. And over the last 15 years, I've definitely come to the conclusion that first, it's not enough. Like, it's not enough to just center yourself in a business. Like, there's other aspects to being a person, and you need to honor those. But also just like that it's a lie, that there's no finish line in entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. It is a continuous thing. So you have to set it up as sustainable. And if your models aren't sustainable, as they often aren't in food, you'll burn out. And then what do? Right. And then you have to recover from the burnout. So I see it like across society. It's not just people working in food. I think like we've really lost, we've lost a lot of like what it means to be a family, you know, like we send our seniors off. We don't want to deal with them. We don't want them in the home. We want them somewhere else that is, we'll pay for it. But I think if we had a basic income and we had more people at home, that idea of home would be bigger again, right? There would be someone there that could, and then you could have more multi-generational family homes. So yeah, I think it's important to just, I mean, I'm not listening to that voice anymore. It's like, just hustle. I moved my whole family to Nova Scotia recently, like so now, and that was why. It was, the hustle wasn't getting me where I thought I was going to get, and I had given up too much, and I had to just refocus around the things that are really important that I know we're going to be there in 20, 30 years. My business is really important, but it's not as important as all that stuff.
There's like so much wisdom in the idea of like hustle less, sometimes we need to, but then it's also like there's so much truth in that idea that like, it's actually not going to change your circumstances if you just hustle forever.
And there's times of hustle, like holidays, right? Of course. Yeah. Like it's going that's going to be a hustle, and it feels great. Like you get a rush out of that kind of temporary hustle.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of like having like decentering yourself from your business and having the business be built around a core group of people that can all sort of take care of it together is also like a very smart direction to go in. And it sounds like you've got some long-term employees, your partner, yourself, and you all kind of contribute in a way. And I also really relate to having to like put in this massive boundary to like create space between you and your business in order to like live a more balanced life. Like you moved to Nova Scotia, I've started working for the Better Way Alliance, which takes up, you know, a third of my week or whatever. And I'm like, sorry, everyone, like you got this. I trust you. You know what to do when I'm not there. And it's actually like taking on this extra, what I was like concerned about being extra work has actually like, it hasn't necessarily reduced my workload, but it's put in these like really healthy boundaries where I'm like, And it's like allowing my business to grow without me, which is for me really important. So I think that's like a really good place for us to like wrap up because it feels very like full circle. But I did want to ask you before we say goodbye, if there's anything specific or particular that you want to plug or talk about yourself, your business before we say goodbye.
I am really proud that our second cookbook is coming out March 14th. This is it. Oh, you can't see it. There.
There we go.
It's called Gatherings. And it is all about throwing a party and reconnecting to people and recreating connections in a time when we've lost a lot of the connections. I'm really proud of it. My kid made a recipe from it this morning and it worked. And our first cookbook is still available as well. You can get it at your local bookstore, Chapters, Indigo, anything like that. We would love for you to pick up either and support us in that way too.
That's amazing. Yeah, because we all don't live in Hamilton. We all can't go there, but we can buy your cookbook. And that sounds so amazing. Thank you so much, Josie. It was amazing talking to you.